This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
The nutters at the Greens reckon they know what the price for rent is, or should be, for each of the 3 million rental properties, plus the tens of thousands of items that are sold by the supermarkets every day. They don't trust the basic laws of economics. Wacko!
Wacko! Crazy!
That boy needs therapy. This coming from
I'm
a man
down
who's
the couch.
Yep. Twitter handle is the kook. You're a kook.
The kook. He's a literal wackos. Kook. But also, like, shouldn't we let him in on a little secret that I don't trust the basic laws of economics? I actually don't.
There's a housing crisis and a cost of living crisis, and there are more billionaires than ever, and wealth inequality is out of control. But people just don't seem to trust the system.
That's weird. I don't know why. If they just trusted it, then things would be a bit better. Maybe it's the mistrust that's the problem, I think. Or is it the wackos and the cuckoos?
The wackos, the Fruit Loops. This is in response to, Max tweeting about the Queensland Greens just announcing their state candidates, right? The new slate of state candidates,
yeah,
and the new policies.
The rental policy, yeah.
Right, to freeze rents and cap rent increases and put price on that. And Stephen Koukoulas, Labor Economic Advisor, Head of Global Strategy, TD, former advisor to Julia Gillard, I believe, on economic matters, was very upset indeed and called us wackos. I think he also then retweeted Max's response.
Yeah, because wasn't Max this is embarrassing for an economist, basically, to not know that this exists in many, like this has been done before?
Deeply embarrassing for someone who describes themselves as an expert in economics to apparently miss the fact that countries and states around the world cap rent increases. And no, I don't trust an economic system that has created a massive housing and rental crisis.
Mm.
And then his reply to that is, if you want to see what sort of economic vandals the Greens are, here's the post. Stop, Max, please.
Wait, so that's the post. All right, so that's the worst, the most vandalistic we get.
Yes.
Is Max being like, homelessness bad.
This is bad. Fucking Stephen Koukoulas. Now, he came on to Nightly. I don't know if we've talked about this. Years ago, he came on to Nightly. He'd played the boomer. We did the boomer, smashed avocado debate. We sort of had a crack at that. He was a relatively good sport. He had annoying positions, but whatever. But then I followed up to him for the book, right? I'm talking with the book. And it gets to a point in the conversation where I'm like, look at this data. Look at how home ownership has crashed for people aged under 40, right? They've taken it's declined significantly, and for people on the lowest incomes, it's crashed by about 40% over the time since the 1980s. How do you explain that? Like, if everything is just as hard for young people as it is then, and his answer was lifestyle changes.
Really?
People don't really buy houses.
Lifestyle changes. That's not even I feel like there are more mainstream liberal economic views than it's just lifestyle changes, you know?
Yeah, he'd probably walk away from that now, probably deny that he said it now, whatever. But Jesus Christ. I mean, just in the basic laws of economics, says the advisor to the Labor Party, which is at least in theory supposed to have some kind of critique of the economic order under which we live. I mean, it seems that all he does on social media is just basically defend capitalism and punch left constantly and sort of imply that if you can do anything outside of market forces to address the ways that people are hurting right now, you're a fucking wacko.
Wacko. It's just so funny the way that he just put wacko. It's very, it's almost Trumpian, isn't it? The way he's just put wacko at the end.
The Greens
like,
are economic
like this.
Vandals.
Crazy.
Sad. Wacko.
Sad.
Crazy loopy Max Chalamatha.
The Greens say they want to freeze rents. Sad. It'll never work. It'll never work. The worst, terrible, bad idea. I really need to work on my Trump. Just for this show, if Come nothing on. Else.
How ironic for a Green senator to lecture a CEO on business. I would have gone the Julia Gillard route. I will not be lectured to about economics by this man. Look, this is the Americanization.
We're stuck with the hosts of Chapo Shithouse podcast.
This is a serious danger to Australia.
What is this show, you ask? Why, this is Serious Danger, a podcast about green politics in Australia. I'm Tom Ballard. That's Emerald Moon. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri country, the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people in the Kulin Nation.
Hello, I'm in Mianjin this week. I'm on Yagga in Turrbal country. This show is not an official Greens Party podcast, but it is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin. This week, we are discussing the two very grim stabbing attacks in Sydney that everyone's and the way that the country's been sort of processing it over the last week, what it all means. And then we find out if Green Senator Nick McKim is sending Woolworths Brad Banducci to jail. Is it happening?
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Big thanks to GH who got on board the Patreon this week. Thank you very much. You can pay just $3 a month and you get bonus content on our Patreon, patreon.com/seriousdangerAU. Thanks very much if you do that already. We just released a Patreon app this week, our profile of Jim Penman, real name David.
Yeah, of course. Classic.
Exposed.
Yeah.
Exposed as a fake Jim.
Doxed.
We talked about this a bit at our live show. You'll be hearing that. But also there was bonus content that we didn't get to in regards to his views on eugenics that we do dive into in a little recording session.
Yeah.
That's well worth your time. What did you think? How does that make you feel?
It was an uncomfortable episode. I think you were right that to do it outside of the live show. Having said that, well, because it would have ruined the immaculate vibe of the live shows. Speaking of which, we've sold out. I didn't know this. Our Mianjin Brisbane shows are sold out. Is that true?
Yeah, baby.
That's not fake news. That's crazy. Thanks for fucking buying tickets, everyone. That's really cool. And we can't wait to see you there. And while you're there, Tom would like you to come and also see him because his shows haven't sold out, which is interesting.
Yes. I'll tell you what's not fucking full. All these people buying Serious Danger tickets. You don't want to come and see Tom Ballard by himself without Emerald? Come on.
He talks about me. So
you do get a mention. Sometimes the line about you in the show gets laughs. Other times it just gets like, woo.
They're like
yeah. Huh? I listen to that podcast. They're cool.
Yeah.
I love people to see at the Brisbane Comedy Festival. It's also coming to Perth and Sydney and Newcastle and Brunswick Heads. End the plug here. Although the links are in the show notes if you want to come along, we'd love to see you there. But
now the plug's ended.
Now it's all over, done.
Tonight, news we hope we'd never have to deliver in this country. A mass killing at Sydney's biggest shopping centre.
Alrighty, so it's been a bit of a fucked week for stabbings. there have been two major ones.
A better week for stabbings, really.
Well, good week for stabbings. Good week if you love stabbings, which hopefully you don't. I mean, I guess throughout this show we're going to be discussing the question, stabbings good or bad, and see what kind of verdict we come to.
I think there are good arguments on both sides.
Yeah, well, we want to be balanced. We want to be fair and balanced because we're journalists. So that's what we're going to do here. Two significant stabbings within days of each other, public stabbings that have garnered significant media attention and a lot of discourse. So we wanted to run through some of those things. The first one obviously being Saturday afternoon, Bondi Junction, Westfield Shopping Centre, where six people were killed and further 12 were injured. And then on Monday night, there is an alleged stabbing at the at an Assyrian Christian church service in Western Sydney. No one was killed there. It seems that the two people who were hospitalised have now been released from hospital, but the alleged attacker has been charged with terrorism offences. Just before, I have a few things that I think we can discuss that have come out of these stabbings, but, what do you feel is the overall vibe or takeaway that people that's permeated most strongly throughout the Australian and particularly political discourse in the last weeks of these?
Jesus. It's hard to say. I mean, how much they have to do with each other I think is probably very much up for debate. We might talk about that. And there is just automatically when these two things happen close proximity to each other, people are compelled to draw comparisons or say things about both of them at the same time. I mean, it was extraordinary how quickly the Bondi Junction incident, tragedy, horrible attack, how immediately people jumped to cite calls of Islamist terrorism, terrible media behavior by wrongly identifying this guy, Benjamin Cohen, who's now going to sue Channel 7, which I think is fantastic. Fucking sue that organization into oblivion is my hot tip.
Yeah.
take them out.
Yeah.
How this was twisted into some kind of weird, you know, anti-Palestinian accusation in some quarters, as if this was, you know, the evidence as to why we need to support Israel, some fucked up shit. And, of course, the horrific reality of truth under it, which is a mental health crisis in this country and deep-seated violent misogyny, which results in the deaths of women every fucking week in this country. My general take, no good news coming out of this, but perhaps deeply depressing just how quickly all that kind of a horrible chat in the immediate aftermath just to me suggested we learnt absolutely nothing from the war on terror, absolutely nothing from the Lint Siege Cafe or when these incidents happened, just people's rush to immediately label it as something. And you saw that from overseas, right? Like there was that Julie Hartley Brewer, that fucking UK commentator who was close the borders or whatever the fuck. Crazy.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest, like, I mean, arguably it's gone worse. Arguably the drive to like have to break the information, to break the news, to have the, you know, to know everything and be the first person to get in with the groundbreaking take is even stronger now than it ever was, even as Twitter/X is arguably dying. It often, that's kind of where it starts. Still, and maybe it's even worse now that platform is such a fucking disaster and will boost the blue checks, who are generally worse, have shit fucking politics and like no regard for facts, will boost their views even further because they've paid for it.
Well, people are prepared to pay for a blue check, so already. Yeah. There's your mental health crisis right there.
So I think like the speculation and the misinformation is one of the most interesting I guess, what's the word, like pertinent parts of these two incidents that have happened in the last week. The tweet that you are referring to, there's this, apparently I hadn't heard of this person, but a British right-wing commentator, Julia Hartley Brewer. Who is she? Do you know anything more about her apart from this? Or
she sucks.
Okay, she
sucks. That's all you need to know. She'd be in the Katie Hopkins school, just absolute a real moron too. I've listened to some of her interviews too, and she'll just be talking or asking questions, and it's clear she has no idea what the hell she's talking about, and will just regurgitate any bullshit right wing talking points. Was a very big fan of Suella Braverman, I believe, the Home Secretary, who wants to send every desperate person fleeing persecution to Rwanda forever.
Right. Yeah. So it must have been like very soon after these attacks that she tweeted, "Another day, another terror attack by another Islamist terrorist. 6 dead, others seriously injured, including a baby," tweeted the British right-wing commentator Julia Hartley Brewer. Granted, she later retracted that when it was determined to be manifestly untrue, but that spread like wildfire. And then kind of at the same time, there's this, what you alluded to, this guy Benjamin Cohen, who was misidentified as the attacker, that actually came from these anti-Semitic accounts. So a lot of the tweets that were identifying him as the attacker were pointing out his Jewish identity. Oh, there was this, I read an article that kind of tracked how this, on the ABC, that tracked how this lie spread, how this misinformation spread around the internet. And it started with really small, like openly, you know, neo-Nazi or anti-Semitic accounts. There's this one that had 37 followers. This account called Sunny Dan seems to be the first one that tweeted it and has a history of reposting anti-Jewish images, posted, "Unconfirmed report, terror attack in Bondi. Terrorist name is Benjamin Cohen, a radical Jew from Bondi, Sydney."
Jesus.
"Only a Jew could stab a baby, making sense now." So that's one. And then like a bunch of other small anti-Semitic accounts start posting the same thing. And then there's this one big account from this like pro-Kremlin anti-Semitic, just like some fucked guy who tweets it to his then thousands of followers, and it goes from there to the extent that, as you say, Channel 7 refers to 40-year-old lone wolf attacker Benjamin Cohen, and as this guy's dad is like tweeting, you know, "Stop fucking saying, like, my son is alive and well, this isn't him, could you please stop misidentifying him?" And yeah, as you say, he's suing Channel 7, and best of luck to him.
Best of luck. This is, yes, one case where we're very pro using the courts to drive that organization to the ground. So how did they settle on him? Was he in the the shopping mall? Was he like a victim or a witness or nearby? Like, do we know
to
how?
To me, it sounds like they Channel 7 just spin a giant guy. Wheel
and sort of like throw a dart and be like, hey, let's go with this one.
Well, Channel 7 was going off these tweets and it seems like.
Off these the tweets? Tweets?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, I thought the tweets were responding to the news reports. You're saying,
no.
Fucking hell. Jesus
no.
Christ.
Yeah. They've just, they're like, oh, the Nazis are saying it's this random guy. That's. Let's do that. Let's go
Sources
with that.
Sources say.
Yeah. Yeah. They love – they've got a knack for picking the right side, don't they? Channel 7, they love – what's his name? Disgraced war criminal. We spoke about him. Ben Robert Smith. They love Bruce Lerman and they love the Nazis. Anyway, you can't defame an organization, so I'm allowed to say that. That's confirmed.
Good say.
But, yes, obviously it emerges that this is the Bondi stabbings, that it wasn't terrorism after all. It wasn't religiously motivated. It eventuates that it was this 40-year-old man who had a history of mental illness, including schizophrenia. He'd been diagnosed when he was 17. He had been he was homeless. He had travelled, like was kind of estranged from his family, had been living in Brisbane and come back down to Sydney. And it was clearly a mental health crisis, and the police confirmed that it didn't seem to be motivated by any kind of religion or ideology.
Mm.
I think there's some, because then there's this discourse around like, once they find out that he's white, then he's very sick, or people having a go at his parents, for example, like his the fucking really awful or heartbreaking interview with his parents where they're obviously heartbroken, and the bit where his dad says that he became a servant to his son when he found out he'd been diagnosed with mental illness is really heartbreaking. And he's saying, you know, I love my son. He's a very sick boy. And people are saying, how could you say he's a very sick boy, you know? As soon as it's like he's a 40-year-old man, he's not a very sick boy, he did this. But he is. Like, obviously he is a very sick boy, right? Sick. Like,
and let's,
that could be true.
I'm hearing those interviews with his dad. I'm like, let's not, I'm not going to start telling this father, this grieving father who must be going through something.
Yeah.
That none of us
and they like
staked imagine.
Out his home. They like went to his home. He's trying to just, they had like camera crew, like paparazzi basically at this dad's home.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we should say that, you know, overwhelmingly people experiencing mental health difficulties are much more likely to be the victims of violence than the perpetrators, and that's important to keep in mind. And yes, certainly I think there's definitely an argument when you look at, say, mass shootings in the US, the different way that those that are treated compared to terrorist attacks when they are perpetrated by someone of a different race. Like, it's just true that in society we approach these things differently. But this is a very different case, right? Like there is no political ideology, there is no motive or political action, as twisted as terrorists lethal actions may be. There is some kind of ideology or political purpose or some kind of point trying to be made that is just clearly not what is happening here. Some people seem to think that the definition of terrorism is if it causes terror, if people were terrified. That's not technically how we think
exactly. Like, some would argue, there is an ideology at play here, and the ideology is misogyny.
Right.
Because, the next thing, like you can see, it was five women and one man were killed, and it's clear from the footage that the attacker, in Bondi, is targeting women, avoiding men.
Mm.
And the police confirm that. And his parents say in these interviews, like they're asked, did he have a problem with women? They say, yes, he wanted a girlfriend and he had no social skills.
Mm.
I think what I take issue with, though, is people being like, well, the problem is that we immediately label, you know, brown people terrorists as soon as they're involved in any sort of, or even just not even involved, but present near a crime, label them terrorists. And the solution is like, label this terrorism, like it's terrorism and, you know, it's terrorism against women. I'm like, actually, no, I mean, I take issue, like, I don't think the solution is label more things terrorism and use our fucking cooked terrorist, like counterterrorism laws and really restrictive and whatever, intrusive counterterrorism laws in more instances, because I just don't think that ever helps anything. Like, I don't think that's the solution, is call more things terrorism and crack down on more terrorism.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that, yes, labeling terrorism matters in terms of response, the investigation into it, and there are certain, I guess, powers or even literally parts of law enforcement that are activated if something is actually specifically designated a terrorist incident. Yes. But I just think to label that stabbing as a terrorist incident is just to fundamentally misunderstand what it was and what was going on. Obviously, we'll get more details as time goes on, but that just does not seem to be what it is.
And I don't think that you can enforce your way out of terrorism. That's the thing. Like, I don't think those laws are very effective.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Mm. And I don't know, is misogyny a political ideology with end goals and with a political program behind it?
I mean, arguably, like you could say that misogyny is an ideology that is aiming for the maintained supremacy of men over women, you know, the subjugation of women to men and women in particular roles and men in particular roles under a patriarchal system. Like, I think you could, there is something about the response to this that has been, you know, all these people posting like enough is enough, that this is about men's violence against women and there is a problem with men's violence against women, but there's something about this that I don't know how I feel about making the Bondi stabbing about the problem of men's violence against women.
Mm.
Probably because I do think that, yeah, like if the mental health issues were probably properly addressed, I don't know if this would have happened. Mm. But I guess like maybe there is some merit probably, yes, to the idea that, you know, misogyny flows from the top and that it's a structural issue and that we do need to, you know, it starts from the bottom as well, that it's, you know, about having conversations with other men and pointing misogyny out in everyday settings and that contributes to a culture in which someone who is vulnerable to that kind of ideologies or to becoming fixated on something in a way that it might drive them to violence if they are mentally ill, like that we can change that with the culture in which they're surrounded.
Mm.
But I don't know.
It's hard, right? Because obviously it's tempting to label this as something, and obviously people do that extremely quickly, completely erroneously. You know, this is 100% this is 100% terrorism, this is 100% mental health.
Yeah, people want a simple, that's right. Like they want to simplify it. Yeah.
And then there's maybe the move to the nuanced take, which is it's 40% misogyny, you know, 35% mental health or whatever. And like that's probably just as silly, right?
Yeah.
And really, I mean, immediately the fact that the victims and their families need to be cared for and this person needs to be, you know, held to justice / you know, provided the support that they need. I don't know. It seems to me that a functioning, well-funded mental health system would reduce the incidence of things like this happening. That's obviously the dream, the ideal, and that's not what we have in this country. And so you simply can't ignore that as far as
I'm concerned. Because Adam Bant's thread kind of does, like, it covers all the bases, right? And it's interesting because I saw one of Adam's tweets being shared around that I was kind of like, I don't know if that really hits it for me, but I now see that was part of a broader thread that does cover more of the things that I agree with. So I'd seen the tweet that's like, to every man reading this, what conversation will you have and what action will you take to stop the spread of misogyny? We know we must do better. And I'm like, is it just about men talking to men? Maybe that's part of it. But he does what he says. We know men's violence is fueled by gender inequality and exacerbated by systemic underfunding of mental health, crisis housing, and homelessness services. If we want our communities to be safer, then governments must fully fund the services and education we need. I agree. Well said. But yes, so there's. I just want to, you know, and we should say it was the five women and one man killed in Bondi. It was Cheng Yixuan, Pikria Dashia, Ashley Good, Dawn Singleton, Jade Young, and Faraz Ahmed Tahir, who was the unarmed security guard and a Pakistani refugee. This is one of the other elements of some of the discourse this week, because a lot of the people involved in the Bondi stabbing, the, you know, victims and people who kind of took on like a vigilante role or tried to stop the killer, weren't citizens, and there's a discussion around whether they deserve citizenship deserve to stay in Australia, whereas every other refugee somehow doesn't. So It was, first of all, okay, so first of all, there's bollard. There's a video of the man who stands at the escalator and holds the bollard to try and apprehend the attacker in Bondi. He is a French national. And on Wednesday-ish or Tuesday, some, you know, early in the week, Albanese says, we're going to let this guy stay in Australia. We're going to make him a permanent resident. That's happened by Thursday, despite his lawyers being like, well, the Prime Minister doesn't have the power to do that. And yet somehow it just, it's happened already by Thursday. Obviously, then there's questions about, you know, Albanese is asked, will you also consider citizenship for this Pakistani security guard, Mohammad Taha, who was stabbed in the stomach when he confronted the killer? He has this temporary visa that's due to expire within weeks. He's saying, I really would like, he's in hospital saying, I really would like to be considered, please. I think maybe I also deserve this. And also I have these other, you know, some of my comrades, like some of my colleagues should probably also be considered. Albanese has said, I think that he will consider that, but I don't know that anything's happened. But this just goes to show, right, like how quickly you can just offer someone fucking citizen, like, or residency. And it's as easy as that.
They did it for Khawaja. Remember that, the cricket player, like who was the refugee guy? Like they fast-tracked his refugee application so he could play cricket for Australia. I mean, this system is insane. And at the same time, as we're doing this bullshit Trumpist, you know, fucking hard border bullshit that we discussed on the live show a couple of weeks ago, in the same context of this, in which apparently Australia's prepared to write off entire countries and saying you're not allowed a visa here at all. To keep us safe, like all that, you know, Fortress Australia bullshit, and then on a whim can just offer it. All you need to do, folks, to get security and dignity in this country is to be stabbed in the stomach or to confront a knife-wielding maniac that's been let down by our own poor mental health system. So there you go, folks. That's easy.
Well, you
that's
can be a rare, yeah, like you can be a rare good brown person so long as you're, you know, protecting like I don't know, you're on the news and people can then suddenly realize that you're a person, as if any other person, human being in that situation, which, you know, refugees are, would probably do the same thing, but they're not humanized most of the time until they're actually thrust in that position, because we are a deeply xenophobic racist society.
You gotta get a nickname, folks. You gotta be Bollard Man. Yeah.
Bollard Man, that's right. They should put that on their applications. Maybe it would help. I don't know. Fucking hell. Obviously, so apparently in the wake of the Bondi Junction attacks and the misinformation around it being an act of Islamist terrorism, the organization that gathers reports of Islamophobic attacks had reported a rise in those kinds of attacks. And no doubt that has obviously now been heightened because of the second stabbing, the Monday night, which was during this church service where a 16-year-old boy allegedly comes in and tries to stab the bishop and a reverend as well. And there was also a 60-year-old man who was attending the church service who was allegedly stabbed. And the boy said, the boy yelled Allahu Akbar when he'd come in, and then he, as he was being pressed onto the floor, said he wouldn't have done this if the bishop hadn't insulted his prophet, the prophet Muhammad. And so because of that, like the following day already, police have come out and said, yes, it's a terrorist attack. This one is terrorism, we've decided, and the boy's now been charged with committing a terrorist act. He's been refused bail. As we record this on Friday, I believe he's appearing at a bedside court hearing. So we'll see what happens there. That carries a maximum life sentence. I think what's interesting here is probably because of the what happened on Saturday, then there's people almost conflating the two and being like, oh, well, maybe this is also a mental health issue. Is it, or is it terrorism, or is it both? Because that's so fresh in our mind. Mm. What do you think about this one? Because as I understand it, there's been no confirmation. Like, it sounds as though the boy had appointments with psychologists. He had engagement. He had an appointment coming up with a psychiatrist. His parents said they suspected that he was maybe autistic, but he didn't have a diagnosis. But the police are basically saying there's no mental health diagnosis. This is terrorism. It's ideologically motivated.
Jesus Christ. So because he's charged with a terrorist act, he could be looking at life imprisonment.
Yeah.
Whereas presumably if this is attempted murder or manslaughter, or you know, if someone else stabs someone else and they don't die, they wouldn't be looking at anywhere near that kind of punishment.
Yeah, like I guess that's right. Yeah, because as I said, like no one died in this. It looks like it was relatively minor injuries because the it was like a switchblade, as I understand it, that didn't kind of flick out properly. And so ironically, rather than injuring the people that he was trying to attack very well, it sounds like he really badly injured his own hand. And some reports are even saying that he severed at least one finger.
Oh, Jesus.
In the ensuing kind of scuffle, it sounds like that happened.
It's his first stabbing. Yeah. You know, it's not going to go great.
it sounds like it was his first stabbing, although he had been charged previously for being in possession of a switchblade. There's some – I saw some reports around like, oh, he had a switchblade. Switchblades are banned in Australia. I think it's actually just that you're not meant to have a switchblade in a public place. So right. He's done that before, and he was out on a good behaviour bond following that.
Safety of your own home. Okay. Yeah. Well, now we get into the very messy territory of like, okay, if you are committing a terrorist act, you know, can you be considered healthy? If you're a suicide bomber blowing yourself up for your cause, can we say that you have good mental health? What is brainwashing? What is, and you know, you get a little bit controversial here. I mean, how much is religion brainwashing? Are people who are devoutly religious mentally well, particularly if it leads them to do quite extreme things? Yes. Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of people would argue that, if there's a spectrum, the thresholds on each spectrum are perhaps different depending on what religion we're talking about and probably what race you are. Yeah. I think that that's arguable. I did think it was interesting Fahad Ali tweeted about this and was basically saying, you know, this was an act of terrorism. I don't think it's a question of mental health. He says there was a clear ideological bent to this. Mm. We know what this kid was doing.
But he sort of seems to be saying that a 16-year-old can't be radicalized without inspiration, encouragement, grooming from other source. I mean, yeah, I mean, 16 is an adult in the eyes of the law, basically.
But they are criminally responsible.
They're criminally responsible. Okay, right.
10 to 17, they're treated like they should be dealt with under youth justice legislation rather than adult criminal code. And I don't know how that affects terrorism charges, to be honest. I suspect that there are probably carve-outs that allow terrorism charges to be applied in a similar way to children as they would be to adults, because that's the kind of fucked stuff that we do with terrorism charges.
See, again, it's such a cooked system. I mean, like a life imprisonment sentence for this 16-year-old, is that supposed to be a deterrent? Like, do we think a deterrent or a rational deterrent has any impact on anyone considering doing such a thing? I mean, clearly this young person was deeply failed. Or something went extremely wrong to lead them to a point where they thought the best thing to do was to stab a bishop for fuck's sake. So,
well, yeah, exactly. That's right. Like, that is the thing. Yeah, and this is why I say, you know, why I feel skeptical of just being like, oh, well, let's call terrorism for what it is and use the laws that we have designed for that. Mm. But I'm like, but those laws don't really solve the problem, do they? Like, it's clearly it's a social and a cultural problem that this wasn't identified sooner. I think it's interesting that his family is saying there was no signs of radicalization. They're pretty much entirely shocked by this having come on, which is quite interesting. But clearly he was vulnerable. Like they'd identified that he maybe had, you know, that they'd made appointments with a psychologist and had thought maybe he was autistic. So they know probably that he's vulnerable. And this is clearly a situation where he has decided to target in a very public manner. Like that's kind of the defining feature of this, is that this service was being live streamed because this is a very well-known popular bishop who has gathered this kind of following online, apparently a combined, you know, between the church and him where they live stream it. It's like hundreds of thousands of followers and people view these videos. The videos are very, what's the word? Like they're controversial and they're he's a, you know, quote unquote firebrand bishop. Mm. He espouses these hyper-conservative views. He says that homosexuality is a crime in the eyes of God. He said that the COVID-19 pandemic was a quote unquote plandemic, criticized lockdowns and vaccines. He also strongly criticizes liberal Christian denominations. He, I think, split from another Assyrian Christian church and formed his own kind of denomination. And he strongly criticizes other religions, including Judaism and Islam. And
he's the Ralph Babbitt of the religious world, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. Very he's UAP. Just like, fuck it all. Conservative, yeah.
Hates lockdowns, a lot of splits, a lot of
yeah.
beefs lot going of splits, on with everybody yeah. else.
Yeah. Anyway, and so obviously, like, but you're right. Like, I don't think it sounds as though there was this kind of, you know, discourse online. Like, there were comments on his videos online about targeting him and calls for violence against him. And this young kid has decided to take it upon himself. And you're right. I don't think that like, I think that while yes, it could be defined as an act of terrorism, it is targeted. It is worth noting that, you know, Syrian Christians have been persecuted and have been subject to, you know, Armenian genocide. And a lot of that is tied to, as Fahad Ali points out, a similar ideology to which this boy was kind of espousing. Mm. But would he have done it if he had appropriate social and health supports in place? And I guess in terms of what terrorism does, in terms of, yes, sparking or like enforcing divisions within society and sparking further violence, certainly it looks like the stabbing at the church did that, because it then led to this huge, I guess, riot afterwards, which sounds pretty fucking scary. Mm. So the boy is like barricaded inside the church, as we said, with probably at least one severed finger, and with first responders, as this crowd of people gathers outside. I've seen reports, like I've seen one report that said 600 people. I've seen another that said up to 2,000 people. So I don't know how many people converged on this church, but they're outside the church demanding that police release the boy. As he's inside, they're hurling bricks, bottles, and fence boards at police. Two police officers were hospitalized. Several police vehicles were damaged. It took hours for them to get the situation under control. It sounds like apparently or reportedly text messages were being sent around calling for the Assyrian Christian community to retaliate against Muslims. The family of this boy has since left their home for fear of retaliation. And there's been a lot of, yeah, kind of condemnation from the Lebanese and Muslim community, saying that the response to this is inadequate, and also they're saying that, you know, maybe the declaration of terrorism was premature. Mm. But yeah, this sounds like the riot sounds pretty nuts. Apparently one person has been charged already as of the time of recording on Friday, but police have said that they were going to pursue further charges against people who are involved in that afterwards. But yeah, it sounds like actually what happened after the alleged stabbing was much more intense in a way than that incident itself.
And what do the Greens say about all this? Are we against it? I think we're against all this, yeah?
Well, we haven't. The Greens. yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've checked the Greens' policy platform, and I don't think they explicitly are opposed to stabbings, which is interesting. Make of that what you will. Make of that what you will.
Silence is deafening, yeah.
I think, well, okay, so the political response to this riot is obviously is grieving, you know, to both instances, I think, but particularly to the Bondi stabbings. Mm. It was just kind of shock and you know, solidarity with the families of victims. But pretty immediately there are these calls to expand police powers or make penalties for knife crime tougher. There's things like calling for protective clothing for security guards. There's also this inquiry, I think, will examine like the police response and also the police response to people like this, like why the Bondi killer maybe wasn't identified as a threat before this. But again, I just think there's always this, you know, this examination of why didn't we know this was going to happen? They were known to police. And I, to be honest, I don't really know if you can, like, you can't predict some of this stuff sometimes. I don't, yeah, like not to say the cops are doing their best. I certainly don't think that. But it's more that I just don't think that the cops are capable of, you know, predicting and preventing attacks like this.
Certainly without, yes, if you are to go down that path, you need to have some very serious considerations of, yeah, civil liberties, because we know, particularly in the war on terror, you saw preventative detention orders, this idea that this person looks suspicious, so let's lock them up in case they do something.
Just in case.
You know, might
just
already.
Just in case.
Well, yeah, pre-crime bullshit.
Yeah.
The guns discourse I thought was very funny. He's like, this is why Australia needs guns to stop such things, to stop the knives, we need the guns. It's like, Jesus
Christ. I mean, that's got to be a pretty minority discourse, right? Like, I think most people are saying it's great. This is such a rare, this scale of casualty and injury in, you know, a public attack in Australia is rare because of our strong gun laws and happens pretty fucking frequently in America. I think the calls for police powers to stop and search people in public places for weapons are interesting because this is something that's been happening in Queensland politics over the last couple of years. They, in response to stabbing deaths, particularly of young people, they introduced these police scanning powers in a couple of trial areas, like on the Gold Coast, and the trial showed that actually the trial was like, there's no real evidence that this has prevented any weapons offences, and the majority of charges that police make are drug charges, basically. Right. They will see someone that looks like they might be able to get something off, and there's even reports of police being directed to, like, that they could use these new powers to search people for drugs and, like, rack up possession offence charges effectively. And that's what has happened. And yet they expanded them anyway. They were like, great success, we found all these weapons, not pointing out that, yeah, like, they probably would have found them anyway and they wouldn't necessarily have been used, and they targeted certain groups and they actually just ended up pulling, you know, more people in for non-violent offences. But they've expanded them now to all safe night precincts and all public transport. To do it in public transport, I mean, talk about just like targeting poor people. Yeah. But anyway, and then there was this really horrific attack actually on a grandmother. I don't know if you heard about this, but yeah, like a few weeks ago now, maybe even months, in Ipswich. And there were calls then to expand those powers to shopping centres. And so the Queensland Premier this week has kind of been indicating, oh, yeah, we were already considering that. This is even more argument for that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see those stop and search powers introduced in a few jurisdictions, probably New South Wales and Queensland. And like, the problem is that there is a reason that police generally have a requirement to have a reasonable suspicion before they stop and search you, because otherwise they can just do whatever the fuck they like and they will pick certain people and bring people in largely for non-violent things like having some fucking weed on them. And yeah, we know that it impacts on marginalized groups and it's a violation of civil liberties, but these media events happen, and these events happen where people are so shocked and outraged and grieving what's like an undeniable tragedy. And I think it's gotten worse and worse over time, where politics becomes this competition to just like jump on that and have a response to that and be like, yes, we're responding to this thing, when actually it shouldn't be so reactive. Well, it shouldn't be like that.
No, particularly as, and it's hard, you know, it's important, difficult, but important to keep in mind in the wake of instances like this, that crime is record lows, right? Like, crime is trending down across the board. There is, you know, whenever there's a brief uptick anywhere, people start to lose their minds and say everything's out of control. But the impression that you would get from a ridiculous, sensationalized media is that, you know, crime's out of control and crime's everywhere you look, when in fact, in many respects, our cities are safer than they've ever been, and crime is actually trending down, serious crime. The knife stuff too. Look, this might surprise you. I don't know much about knives and how they work and knife crime and what's used and stuff, but regulation of knives seems sort of a bit more sillier to me, because it's like, we all have knives. We all have access to knives. I don't know if there's a huge difference between, you know, a switchblade knife. I guess that's easier to conceal, which is one factor. But I'm just saying, like, if you want to go out and stab someone, you can go to your kitchen drawer, or you can go to, you can steal a knife from a cafe. Like, you know, the access to sharp blades that we have by nature of the fact that we eat food just means that the access to that is quite substantial.
Yeah. And it's already restricted. Like, in Australia, it's already, you're not allowed to carry a switchblade in public, you know?
Yeah.
Like, in fact, I think you're not meant to carry most knives other than, like knives that are clearly for eating, or like a utility knife in public. So, but obviously people do it. Anyway, horrific areas. It's very scary, but the answer is not more cops and tougher laws. Our take: stabbing bad.
For the record.
And Sydney and Australia suffered an unspeakable tragedy on the weekend on Saturday at Bondi Junction. And my sincerest condolences and sympathies to the families and friends of those who lost their lives, and my wishes for a speedy recovery to the injured. And I know that's going to take years, both physically and mentally. Now, I do have to go out, and I've chosen this to wear. And it's the great Max Mara trans-seasonal jacket. I don't know what I'd do without it. It's wonderful. Ralph Lauren teddy bear T-shirt. Something happy. Just some chinos and some sandals. The bag, the Loewe basket. Now, this is the large version. I have the small, but it's great. I can still use it in this beautiful warm weather. And I've tied a Louis Vuitton scarf on the handle. So I'm ready to go. Looks like I'm going on safari, but I'm probably only going to Woolworths, and that can be a safari in itself. So have a great day, and I'll see you.
Well, from stabbings to grillings. Outgoing Woolworths boss Brad Banducci was threatened with 6 months in jail for contempt of the Senate after he refused to directly answer questions about a profit metric in a fiery Senate hearing that went off the rails on Tuesday. This is the Senate committee looking into the supermarkets and how much they suck and how much they're ripping us all off. It is being chaired by Greens Senator Nick McKim, friend of the show, who was responsible for most of the fieriness and the spiciness. Emerald, did you see much of what the Daily Telegraph called McKim's McCrazy Senate Showdown?
I do like that.
He's McCrazy.
With a K. I saw a little bit. I saw probably more of the coverage of it than I've watched of the actual thing.
Oh, you didn't watch the full 3.5 hours of
Believe it or not, no. Even though I saw the Australian Greens uploaded it in a handy, like, lo-fi, you know, smooth beats of Nick McKim grilling Brad Banducci to study sleep to.
Just a little moments that popped. It's pretty interesting. There's a fair bit to talk about. I mean, the moment itself is a little bit whatever, but then, you know, what was actually going on around it is kind of interesting, I think.
Mm.
This is one of the six inquiries that are happening at the moment into how much the supermarkets suck because the cost of living is really biting and everyone hates it and it's inquiry bonanza. Talk about inflation. How about inflation of inquiries? Am I right?
So true.
The CEOs of Woolworths and Coles had to stand before this committee and answer their questions.
Do people their public flagellation.
Yeah, a little bit of humiliation.
Routine,
which is
yeah.
The least they can do. Obviously, cost of living crisis is still cracking on. People struggling to pay for basics. Meanwhile, Coles is posting net profits of $1 billion in the last financial year. For Woolworths, it's $1.7 billion. And things got particularly heated when Nick McKim tried to get Woolworths CEO Brad Banducci, this is, again, the guy who walked out of the Four Corners interview, media darling, the guy who knows how to talk in public.
This guy's still us. Yeah. Anyway. Wait, didn't he resign?
Yeah, he's the outgoing CEO, but he's still in the position, okay, so he still has to do it, which I think is pretty brutal. I'd just be there, like, be like, funny. I quit this shit. I don't care what you're.
Yeah.
Mr. Banducci declined to confirm if the supermarket giant's return on equity was 26%, twice that of the big banks, but similar to miners, saying it was not the best way to measure the profits of supermarkets. The retailers, like the big miners, argue that other metrics, such as return on capital, are a better indicator of how profitable the business is. Now, Emerald, if you could just quickly run us through the difference between return on equity and return on capital or investment, that'd be great. Just take it away.
Well, I'll put it on my separate Patreon.
What?
That's where I talk about, like, complex economics things, because I don't want to confuse you, Tom. I don't want to confuse the listeners, but you can go check it out on my complex economics Patreon.
Emerald goes deep on economics 101.
No, it's economics 407, actually.
Oh, yeah, you're so advanced.
It's advanced.
All right. Now, apologies if I'm pretty sure I got this. Return on equity is a way to measure profit in relation to shareholders' funds, okay? How much cash that all the shareholders that invest in a company like Woolworths have got, okay? Now, the return on equity for Woolworths is about 26%. For Coles, it's up there at 31%. Okay, now this is very, very profitable. Again, as Nick McKim was prone to point out, that is twice the ROE of Australia's banks, which are the most profitable banks in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But Brad Banducci and other corporate freaks would argue, no, you shouldn't measure it that way. The numbers that we focus on, is the measure of profit against the total capital of the business, which includes debt. All right, when you look at everything the business has, which includes debt, okay, which reduces it significantly to about 10% for Woolworths.
Mm. Why would you want to use that one?
I guess because that's lower. And he'd like to talk about that.
He wants low number. Yeah.
Low number, good number. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the argument is this is much more accurate, or this gives a better reflection of where our profits are really at. But yes, I think it's very obvious to anyone listening to this podcast or with a brain as to why in this particular inquiry, the Woolworths CEO wants to tamper down this idea that they're making out like bandits. Nikim asked Banducci about 39 times just to answer what Woolworths ROE, the return on equity, was in the last financial year. And he was constantly refusing, saying, no, that's not the numbers we focus on. That's not the numbers we focus on. There are different measures that we use, blah, 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 blah. And yes, Nick Nikim got quite frustrated.
Why won't you answer a simple question about what your ROE is? Are you struggling with the ordinary English language meaning of the words that I'm using in my questions? I put it to you, the reason you don't want to focus on return on equity is because you don't like the story that it's telling, which is that you are basically profiteering and making off with massive profits at the expense of farmers, at the expense of your workers, and at the expense of Australian shoppers who you are price gouging.
Boom.
Boom. Mic drop. McCrazy.
He had to remind Banducci that he could be held in contempt of the Senate, which could mean a six-month jail sentence or a fine not exceeding $5,000.
Well, what I'm sure he couldn't afford it. He's just lost his job. Maybe he couldn't afford the fine, so he might end up in jail. I don't know.
Is $5,000 equivalent to 6 months in prison? That seems insane to me.
It does seem insane, doesn't it?
Seems a classic criminal justice system that, if you're rich, you can get away with stuff. You can pay $5,000. It's no worries. Yeah. What do you think about that move? I mean, I hold the Senate in contempt every single day, and I hope I'm not being sent to prison for that. Do we think this is an acceptable approach?
Oh, acceptable?
Yes.
Yeah, of course I think it's acceptable to threaten a CEO with jail.
But they should go to jail for CEO activities, not for...
For being a CEO. Well, it's a CEO. Yeah. Lying and dodgy. But lying and being dodgy is a CEO activity. Come on. Mm. That's core position responsibilities, you know.
That's true.
But... Yeah, I think it's funny. Like, I'm kind of surprised that this worked so well because obviously I think you can see that Nick Bikin was trying to create moments here.
Yes.
Of him going up against this evil CEO. Mm. And the media just fucking took it hook, line, and sinker. I'm actually surprised that they would do that because, first of all, I'm kind of like, well, you're going to ask him 39 times when he just clearly, like, he wants to use different measurement and people don't even really know what return on equity is. Like, it's not as though the public is desperately waiting to hear the figure for return on equity, and yet you're going to push him on that. And then, like, I imagine that maybe the strategy was just as soon as there's something that he clearly is refusing to answer, then you push that, regardless of what the question is and how much you care about getting the answer, because then you can threaten them with contempt. And I suspect that he was planning to threaten him with contempt. But yeah, I mean, that's my, like, behind the curtain. I think it's interesting that it worked, but from a cynical Greens hack political perspective, I'm like, slay, this went so well, and I love the headlines that came out of it.
Yes, Queen. Yes, I mean, if the headlines are Greens Senator grills the CEO of Woolworths, one of the most hated companies in the country right now, it's nothing but good news for us. I don't necessarily agree. I can imagine Nick Bikin not imagining that Brad Banducci would resist so much to admit what this figure is, because Nick Bikin knows what the ROE is, right? He did not expect a fight over getting the CEO of this company. He might give the figure of the ROE and say, okay, but here's the thing, you shouldn't measure it this way, and you can have that debate about what's a more accurate representation of how profitable or how we should measure the profit of Woolworths and how severe the price gouging and how much they're getting away with is. Like, that's a debate that Nick Bikin was probably prepared for. But for Banducci to just simply say, you just would not say the figure, would not confirm the fact that it's 26%. And then eventually, and this is where it all ended up, Banducci appeared to concede that he did not know what the ROE figure was for the most recent financial year, saying that he'd take it on notice and he'd provide it down the track.
Well, what I'm saying is I don't think he expected it to be a fight over the ROE specifically, but I think he could anticipate that Banducci would refuse to answer some question that he had, and that would be an opportunity to threaten him with contempt.
Yeah. Match down the Mathers take. Greens, Nick McKim threatening Woolies CEO with contempt and potentially prison for refusing to answer basic questions about their massive profits is exactly what proper political representation looks like. It's news because we're so used to Labor Liberal politicians rolling over for CEOs.
True.
It's easy to forget politicians are meant to be representing the Australian people when so often you see Labor and Liberal politicians going to billionaires' parties, fuck yeah, taking massive corporate donations and changing the laws to benefit multinational corporations. And that is true. I mean, it was remarkable. We should expect this, but out of the media class and the political press, just this level of sympathy for poor Brad Ducci and Nick McKim was just going
crazy.
Were
people really being sympathetic? Like, was I didn't see any of that because I guess I'm in the bubble. Who is
AFR,
saying give
the
Brad
Australian,
a break?
All these kind of people, really? and even like more progressive economic folks were like, you're economically illiterate, it doesn't matter the ROE. Mm-hmm. Brad Banducci is correct that return on investment is a better measurement, blah, 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 blah. People are saying it was all political theatre and showboating. I'm like, well, welcome to Senate inquiries, my friends.
Yeah, that's what it is. Like, it's a Senate inquiry.
Yeah, people sort of saying it was a gotcha or like, why don't you just look it up? People were trying to pull out a bit of Google it, mate, right, if you want to find out this figure. It's like, no, Nick McKim knew the figure, right? He wants to get Brad Banducci to say the figure to then expose that, you know, put a level of exposure on that, discuss that and lay that out as part of the debate about just how much profit these folks are getting from the massive profits during this cost of living crisis.
Mm. Well, it's also a question about the company which he's representing in the inquiry about his company. So I think the Google It Mate comparison doesn't really hold because that was a question about like a macroeconomic figure.
Yes.
Not something about the Greens that Adam was representing and speaking on at the time. So
right. Okay. Yeah, very true. Yes, and the gotcha. And Nick McKim wasn't like, I don't care if you know this off the top of your head. You can look it up in your annual report and tell it to me. Whatever, it's fine. Let's just get this figure, you know, out there. Let's acknowledge that this is the figure. And his dodginess, his shiftiness in refusing to even say the figure and to move away from it because it might make his company look bad, because it might suggest that they're ripping us all off. You know, that is, the political win. That's the political capital.
Yeah.
And I think we saw that again later on when Nick McKim asked him a very basic question. You know, how much did you earn in the last financial year?
How much did you make in the last financial year, Mr. Banducci?
Senator, that's available in our annual report.
How much did you make in the last financial year?
It's available on page 87 of
our... I'm simply asking you the question, Mr. Banducci. How much did you make in the last financial year?
Senator, as I said, it's available in our annual report.
I know it's available in your annual report, Mr. Banducci, but I'm asking you, in front of a Senate committee, how much you made in the last financial year. I mean, what's your reluctance to disclose that? Hey, round, I'm not asking to the nearest cent. That wouldn't be reasonable. Just in round terms, what did you make last financial year?
Senator, my base salary at Woolworths is $2.6 million. And then I get a short-term bonus and a long-term bonus depending on our performance relative to the metrics I've just talked about on top of that.
All right. And what did that add up to, your total remuneration in the last financial year?
As you would see in our annual report, I think it is $8.4 million in total, Senator.
But there you see Brad Banducci saying, you could look it up in the annual report. You could look it up in the annual report. Nick McKim says, no,
because
just tell
me. Been burnt before by a clip of him looking bad and evil that went viral. And he's like, I'm not going to make the same mistake.
And he can't walk out of this one. I like the Four Corners interview because he will be arrested.
He's like, oh, I tried that last time. They said this time I just have to stay. I have to sit there. Yeah.
Because he's like, you can look it up. And then he proceeds to tell him exactly how much it was. So he does know. So he doesn't need to look it up. He can just tell that information. Yes. And he lowballs the figure. And then sort of eventually Nick has to pull out of him that, it ends up being $8 million. Fantastic.
Is that all?
Tens of million dollars over the past couple of years.
Fucking hell, that's insane, isn't it?
Some other highlights, so to speak, from the inquiry. Banducci and Coal CEO Leah Weckert tried to argue to the committee that Australia is not a duopoly at all. There's heaps of competition going on, Emerald.
Mm-hmm.
Banducci said his business was operating in an incredibly competitive market. And these two CEOs cited the following as examples of the incredible competition in the Australian supermarket industry. Costco.
Okay. Oh, yes, I got to run down to Costco, actually, just grab
Costco,
a few things.
Which is just everywhere and is in no way shutting down stores because they can't compete at the moment. But Costco, but even if they do exist, is a giant American conglomerate. Chemist Warehouse.
I have noticed they're selling almonds, to be fair. So if you need some nuts and seeds and protein bars,
get on down to Chemist
and
Warehouse.
And the Lady Shake.
independent supermarket, generic, Aldi, of course, Aldi, which refuses Aldi to expand. Aldi, maybe,
but like, no.
And a plucky little mum and pop store called Amazon. You see,
Amazon.
There's so much competition going on. Of
Are
course,
people buying groceries from Amazon?
I guess by like online, maybe. Well, but okay. Because Amazon also owns what's the health food store in America? They own
Whole Foods.
Whole Foods, yes, that's all in the Bezos empire too. So I don't know if Whole Foods are entering the Australian market, but there you go. Of course, ignore the fact that Coles and Woolworths represent 65% of the grocery market in Australia. So there's just a fact there which completely undermines whatever the fuck they're saying.
Mm.
And there was also this, and this is like tone deaf even for the CEO of Woolworths. Banducci told the committee Australians wouldn't shop at Woolworths if it price gouged.
If we do not get sales, if we do not generate value for our customers, they don't shop with us for the whole or part of their basket.
Oh. They really think they're earning everything, don't they? Like, this is where I get to the point where I'm like, I think they might actually believe this. I think that thinks he's earned his $8.4 million.
Well, it's just what the market decides that he's worth because of the shitloads of money they're getting from price gouging. But I just love the idea of a family going, you know what? The prices here at Woolworths are just no good.
Kids,
we're not eating
here
this week.
Nope. Yeah.
We're going to skip this one and we're going to wait for these prices to come down.
Yeah.
Just go to your local Amazon or Costco or Kevis. Guys, we're shopping at Kevis Warehouse.
Guys,
we're
at Kevis Warehouse instead. Yeah.
So, look, you know, full applause and solidarity to Nick McKim, who I think is doing good stuff.
Well
and
done.
Yes, we should have more aggressive Senate inquiries where people are actually held to account. That would be good. Green's policy, of course, is something Nick was talking about in subsequent interviews, the divestiture powers, which we've talked about before, about breaking up the supermarkets and trying to destroy or, you know, break down this duopoly so they don't represent 65% of the market. And he's also talking about making price gouging an offence as they do in other countries, so actually making it either a crime or a civil offence that people can be fined shitloads of money for if they're found to be, you know, bumming up the prices. So the inquiries continue, the fight continues, the pearl clutching around this particular moment is ridiculous, and, you know, that anger at these two massive companies that are ripping us off is certainly present and there. I don't know. Do you feel like the momentum is building to result in some serious action or some serious regulatory changes, Emerald?
I don't know, but I do think that the Greens in particular are finally like making ground on the public perception of whether politics and politicians can do something about big corporations ripping them off. Like, I think that's the benefit of this, and we've spoken about it on the show before. I think people will be more likely to be aware of and believe that, there are policy interventions that could stop this. It's just the major parties are not willing to pursue them.
Hmm. He's also talking about donation reform too and sort of saying that these big old companies are big old donors to the major parties. Yes, so that seems like a problem.
Yeah.
So fix that, please.
Well, good news is we're going to fix it. In Queensland, we're going to fix everything because the Queensland Greens just launched our state election campaign, Greensland 2024. Council elections are over. My new best friend is winning a majority in Queensland State Parliament in October. That's right. The party launched the campaign last weekend and announced 6 new candidates. We're saying that we're running to win in up to 10 seats. So that's the 2 seats that we already hold, South Brisbane and Maywa. And then the 6 candidates we announced, I'm not going to be able to remember them all, but I'm going to try. I think we did like Mogul, McConnell, Cooper, Greenslopes. And then I'm going to forget. What have I got? 2 more. What are the other 2? Miller and what's Clayfield? I got them.
Hey, that's nice work. Yeah. Right.
Thank you. And there is a big kickoff party. So if you're in Manjin in particular, come to the kickoff party this coming Wednesday. It is at the Fortitude Valley Music Hall from 6 p.m. I hear that the biggest problem that we're facing right now is that RSVPs may exceed capacity of the venue.
What?
But try and get in. Who knows? It might actually sell out. I think that there's, if you Google like Oh, no, we'll put it in the show notes. We've got a podcast. Let's put it in the show notes and you can click the link there to RSVP. Also, if you're outside of Queensland and you have a little bit of money spare, I'm going to say please donate because we do not have enough money to run the scale of campaign that we need to, and particularly in the context of the LNP vote rising in Queensland. They have so much fucking money. They spent a shitload of money in BCC and we know they have a big war chest for the state election. And so we are going to need a lot of little donations from people everywhere in order to run the campaigns that we need to stop the LNP gaining ground and then also destabilizing us in our federal seats, but also to try and win enough seats to stop the LNP forming government and maybe do some good things in parliament. Anyway, that's my Queensland Greens pitch. Yes, come to the campaign kickoff party the 24th of April. Adam Bandt is coming up. Max Chandler Mayth is going to be speaking. Michael Berkman speaking. Amy McMahon speaking. Trina Massey is DJing. It's going to be really fun. Going to share the plan to win. So if you want to know the secrets to Greensland, come fucking do it.
Very nice. Also, just on election news, I've just seen Adam Bandt tweeted that Samantha Ratnam has won pre-selection for the seat of Wills at the next federal election. That obviously won't be breaking news, I suppose, as people listening to this. No, but there you go. That's just come through this morning. Congratulations to Samantha Ratnam.
So there'll be a new Victorian Greens leader, potentially.
Yes, I guess there will be. And also maybe bye-bye, Peter. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Peter.
Bye-bye.
And speaking of Peter having to go on JobSeeker.
Yes, the Raise the Rate for Good campaign is asking people to get involved, to contact their local MPs ahead of the May budget. Of course, this is the time they're putting all together little budget plans. The pressure needs to be on to say, hey, this benefit that we have, JobSeeker, it's actually keeping people in poverty. It's below the poverty line. That's ridiculous in a country that is as rich as ours, that has so much money, that has just announced $50 billion for defence.
Yeah.
Hey, maybe we should help people not starve and live in their cars. So Raise the Rate for Good has a specific budget campaign for 2024. We'll put a link in the show notes there, all the information there about emailing your MP to keep up that pressure to make sure that JobSeeker is above the poverty line, for God's sake.
Is there like a form email there at that link?
There is, yes.
That's easy. Why wouldn't you do it? And why wouldn't you rate and review the show with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening now? What have you got to? It's free. It's literally free. It costs nothing to give us 5 stars and help the show. It's also completely free to follow us on social media at SeriousDangerAU on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. It's not free to become a patron, but that's why you get extra bonus content for just $3 a month. So it's practically free. It's pretty much free. We've got all these cool bonus episodes over there. SeriousDangerPod.com is where links to everything are. And what else is there to say?
We love you. We'll see you live, Mianj in Brisbane next week.
Oh, next fucking weekend. Yay.
Bye.
Serious Danger Australia.
3 stars.
That's all I talk about in my show now.